Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And there is a whole bunch of things that are just going to continue to happen, and it ain't going to get any better. And as I will say, bombs get dropped on us. You have a choice, folks. You can, you know, just get all caught up in the grievance and the boo-hoos of how evil people have control, how they've manipulated us into this position, or you can start doing something about it. And the question is, what's it going to take? What's it going to take for you to finally start doing something about it and turning the table? So welcome back, Paul.
Thank you, GR. I hope you had a great weekend.
I did. I get bombarded all the time with all sorts of ancillary, did you know about this? Have you heard this? And, you know, that type of stuff. And yeah. I'm not sure. I'm sure you probably heard some of the big revelations that came from Carl Tucker.
Tucker Carlson?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Tucker Carlson.
Yes, I picked up on a couple things. That's correct.
Yeah, and I asked myself, why is it that people are so surprised with what he's telling us?
Right.
And what he's not telling us is really the most alarming thing.
give me an idea what you mean.
Well, I mean, so the last thing he talked about, or the big thing that's going around that I've been bombarded by several people regarding, yeah, you know, this confirmation that the evil global elite are controlling our media and manipulating,
right,
us. I mean, okay, so why is that a surprise?
Correct.
I mean, did he really think the truth was coming out?
So, you know, I guess some people wake up in levels. Does that make sense? So you may be oblivious to something, and then all of a sudden, you know, oh my, you know, this is true. Or, oh my, you know, I think everyone doesn't wake up all at once, and that's part of the frustration, GR. I sense it from you when I listen. You know, it's now or never. Why don't you people see what's going on? And sometimes I'll tell you when they see it. They see it when it hurts them. But when they're comfortable, you know, it's like it's almost invisible, GR.
So I believe that people, even when it hurts them, go into denial. I believe that there are people that, you know, oh, well, you know, I'm just an outlier, you know. A lot of times people go, I mean, they lose their job, and it can't be them. It can't be their performance,
mm-hmm,
right? You know, oh, well, they hated me. Or people make up excuses because the excuse is so much easier than accepting the truth.
Right.
And unfortunately, the other problem is that nobody, I mean, we have abandoned teaching the truth, the Bible and, you know, real science and those types of things in school, to where, you know, it's just about programming, and we're telling you what you need to do and how to react. And this, you know, this gets into philosophy, because, you know, you hear people, you know, like, I'm going to get his name wrong, Peterson.
Jordan Peterson.
There you go. Thank you. So I didn't get it wrong. You helped me. I just didn't get it. I listen to people like him, you know, people inflict that upon me. And I go, you know, this is just like Mark Levin. this is just like many other people out there that are revered by, I would say, you know, patriots, good, wholesome people, and they just don't realize what they're not hearing. And I'll give you the example. I mean, Jordan Peterson is a Canadian, and he understands philosophy. He understands lots of things, but he doesn't understand our Constitution, and he doesn't really understand the uniqueness of our Constitution, nor does he understand. I mean, this is why he, just like Ayn Rand, has, you know, accepted democracy.
Right.
And his view is really, you know, in that general term of the will of the people, you know, and that type of thing, where he doesn't realize that, you know, we actually have a very limited and defined government. And you don't hear him preaching about that. But the other thing that really is absent is, you know, his reveling and, or I should say, you know, his attachment or intimacy with Christ or God. And right. With Mark Levin, when he talks about the history of this nation, he completely obviates its Christian origins, and it completely obviates the religious plight and all of that.
Okay.
He doesn't acknowledge what, you know, the Enlightenment of America and its roots in Christianity. And that's the truth. Our Enlightenment here in America really came from this embracing of liberty and Christianity.
Right.
And so, you know, he just glosses over that type of stuff. And I'm going, so there's got to be a reason why. And Go ahead.
No. So you're speaking of Mark Levin, right?
I am speaking of Mark Levin, okay, as well as Jordan Peterson. I don't think these guys are trying to, you know, help everybody understand that, you know, one, that we have to fight for ourselves. But if, you know, if we do this and we have faith in God and we recognize that, you know, he does want us to be free, that he will bless us. That type of stuff doesn't come out of their mouths.
Right.
It is kind of void. And I'm going, well, why is it that people, you know, don't find this alarming? And so when I look at Tucker Carlson, I, you know, it's not like he's ever talking about he's good. He's a good entertainer, but I don't see him talking about, you know, really, what is it we need to do? Where is the investigation on what people are doing and which ways are effective? And, you know, some analysis on what would he think would be the best way. Where is that?
It's nowhere in the media. And I think Tucker Carlson is probably the best of them for revealing things that people wouldn't otherwise know. But no one, I'm trying to... And I watch him regularly, and I'm trying to think where he asks, okay, here's the problem, now what do we do about it?
Right.
Okay. In fact, I'll tell you about 3 years ago, he interviewed the sheriff. I didn't know that at one point New York City had a sheriff, okay?
Uh-huh.
And so what happened is... this guy started to give him a solution. Get this, Jared, and Tucker cut him off. I was shocked. Okay, in fact, at that time, I canceled my subscription for that very reason, and I started to write to him, but I realized the letter was going to be too long. And here's what happened: this guy was, they were talking about George Floyd, and this experienced lawman was talking about things that police aren't trained to do. Said they're not trained to de-escalate situations. And as he started going down this road, I was shocked. Tucker didn't want to hear it. I actually unsubscribed until I moved across the state. Then I resubscribed to him. So what happens is in my experience, someone tried to offer a solution, and I couldn't believe what I saw. And so what's happening, what we're seeing in the news is that there's all these exposés, and it all looks bad. And, you know, who's got a solution? Well, who wants to know? You know, that's what I'm seeing.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You know, we have... anyway... We've got a solution, and it would be cool if somebody would. Has anyone ever reached out to you in the media and say, "Hey, Gia, we've heard that you've got something. Why don't you share it with us?" Has that ever happened?
So I've actually had Angeline reached out and said, "Hey, you know, you're talking a completely different line, and I'd like you to explain this to me." Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she went through a few of the shows with me, and I went through, answered her questions, and we kind of went through some very important information. And next thing I know, she's come back and she said, she's been working on a federal communications petition.
Oh, she's working a petition.
She's working on a petition, right. And so... Anyway, I've had things like that happen where I've been approached and had people, you know, come to me. And as a matter of fact, I had one of my books purchased, and actually was cited in one of his books in doing some research regarding the unconventional view of the Constitution or a path of the Constitution. In other words, it was kind of like about the Article 5 Convention.
One of his books.
This was Dr. John R. Vile, and I forget the real name of the book he cited me in and cited my book in. But he was really a true – he thought when he was reading that I was really leaning – I mean, so this is how bad that first book was really received and perceived. He thought – now, see – what's interesting is that you know who thinks that book was trying to promote a constitutional convention, and actually in Dr. John R. Vile's book, he basically saw what I was, you know, the way I was speaking and the way I was conveying the message. He just summed me up as a nullifier like John C. Calhoun.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I was trying to nullify federal laws instead of actually forcing the government into compliance. So he didn't see me as a person that was going down the path of enforcement of the Constitution. He saw it completely different, that I didn't agree, or he didn't come to the conclusion that a couple of other organizations had completely misread that, I'm an advocate for the Article 5 Convention, when they, you know, for whatever reason, they completely obviated what I was really doing. But anyway.
Okay.
So, you know, I do get people that come to me, but for the most part, I think it's more of a work that has been, you know, been pretty successful in trying to suppress our message and what we're doing, because there are some active groups that are leaders. They're perceived leaders in the conservative ranks that are deliberately trying to obfuscate, you know, this message and what we're trying to do. And they literally libel me, or they say things that are absolutely, I mean, I don't have time to chase people and sue them. I just don't have that time. We don't have that time, folks.
Right.
And so, you know, the only thing I can say is, if you believe what you were just told and you don't do the due diligence, then shame on you. Because what they're telling you, there is absolutely zero evidence to prove that. Zero. Anyway, so... What I see is within the conservative ranks a very well orchestrated firewall, you know, or I should say a braking system that will not allow the Patriots of America to really unite and start moving towards compliance and moving their state in that direction. Now, right. In some cases, I have run across people that have been, I will just say, in a position that could really do something. And in some cases, I just think that they haven't gotten it yet.
Okay.
And in some cases, I know some people that go, I don't understand what you're really trying to do, and they're stuck in the party process. And this is, but we got to do it this way. This is how we got to do it. Mm-hmm. And, that brings up another point. But, I do get, tickles, but I don't get exposure.
Okay.
That's about it. And so what I've noticed is that in this last legislative session, it's very alarming. State legislatures have basically presented in red states, and I'm trying to get somebody or a few people, as a matter of fact, I know a gentleman who I'm hoping to have on who's running for a position in Iowa. And I'm hoping that you've got some people in Missouri that are running for positions that are going to, champion, calling on the people to unite. It's time we unite. It's time we unite on the Constitution. We're not uniting on GR. We're not reuniting on anything, that is, of man. We're uniting on this Constitution, something bigger and greater than all of us. One of the things that I see is that this whole conservative, break system, this firewall that has been created, everybody out there, whether it be Carlson, Trump, they're all managing a part of that system. Mm-hmm. I see it that way. I see that nobody wants to break away from the direction we're going. They just don't want us to, succeed in uniting. What they want is they're seeking their form of control. It's about managing the energy and controlling that energy at the same time. And I believe that if the people break free, they unite and actually exert their political energy, we will absolutely see states flip, and we will actually see states put the brakes on the federal government or put alarm to them, and we'll actually either see them badly respond, which would actually, this is what will happen. If the federal government decides to actually wage warfare against a few states because they're standing up to them, then, and they're going to try to use a propaganda machine, that'll backfire. That will backfire, because I think that's one of the things that'll really be, the eye-opening awakening that, this is precise, because they've never really directly confronted resistance. They've basically obviated it, and they've just kind of kept the light off of it.
So here's a question. With that in mind, do you think they're seeing it backfire with the Texas border and states starting to support
Texas? No, no. That's
Missouri is apparently it's sent National Guard to Texas as a supposedly 25 other states.
Yeah, but see, now. Texas is not doing what the Constitution demands.
Right.
They're not repelling. They're not asking the states to repel. They're just stopping it. They're making it look like, okay, we're the good guys here. And then when we come in, okay, we're going to kind of manage that border, but we'll still maintain 50-some million invaders in America.
Right. So, in other words, and repel means what it says. And in fact, I had a, I had an animated discussion this weekend with someone who's seeking a presidential nomination. Okay, and what I asked about, and he said to me, there is no state can go to war without a declaration of war. I said, there's an exception. You know where it is? It says Article 4, Section 4. Okay, and that is the United States shall what, guaranteed to every state in this union a Republican form of government and protect it from invasion. I'm not quoting exactly. And then it, it says, you know, on application or of the executive or the legislature not available. And but then the state, how should I say this? It doesn't give the state the power. It recognizes the state has to defend itself in the event that, you know.
It's an Article 1, Section 10.
I'm sorry. You're right.
And it says, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty on tonnage, keep troops or ships of wartime of peace, enter into agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war, unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit delay.
Rich. So, and that's where we are.
Right.
And so it is. So then the militia, right, should be repelling the invasion.
Right.
And they certainly have a right to call on other states to help them repel the invasion.
Right.
Okay. And so what you're saying is, what the reaction we're getting is a tepid 21st century reaction.
Right. And so here's the interesting thing. Most people see the invaders as those people who could scurry across our border. But actually, see, the federal government has been subsidizing and supporting this invasion. And I know people go, well, that's hyperbole. But no, that's not that. This is there's actual evidence, because every time they ship in what they call refugees, they violate the Constitution because they're basically importing invaders.
Right.
So they have in the Constitution the power and the requirement to make uniform rules or uniform law of immigration, or I should say naturalization. And the process is very clear that an individual must apply to become an immigrant. You just cannot come in. The law is very clear on that. So the federal government says, oh, but we made a treaty with the UN that we will help in resettling refugees. Hold on here. Where is that in the Constitution?
It's not.
It's clear that the only treaties that they can make are regarding those things that are in their authority. They don't have the authority to bring, you know, block-granted people in here and bypass the law that the Constitution demands that they have.
Right.
So when we see, you know, these communities that have been, you know, I'll just say erected, that are, you know, calling to prayer or whatever other communities out there. And so here's the alarming thing. We actually have refugees here that have been and have assimilated into the American system actually pretty good. And it's alarming that they actually did assimilate as well as they did, such as the Vietnamese. And believe it or not, some of the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have, you know, movements and pockets that, you know, are embracing and wanting to become, you know, naturalized citizens. Where you see these others, they don't even care. They don't want to assimilate. They want to inflict their law. They want to create their own nations here.
Mm-hmm.
And so those folks, at least those folks who are not on that path and not embracing the rule of law and demanding that the law be complied to, they got to go.
Mm-hmm.
Those who want to actually change our laws and inflict theocracy or some other form of government upon us, then, you know, they've got to go. We've got to go into a break. So when we come back, there's actually one more thing I wanted to bring up, but we'll kind of wait until the break, because I just don't want to boom drop it and then get on to going into the document. So, folks, we're going to have a short break, and we'll have a promo, and we'll be right back. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so one of the things I was also wanting to talk about, and not that the what we're talking about isn't important, but we actually had a group in New York, I just said New York, actually have a petition drive with four or five First Amendment petitions. And one of the first things I noticed in my text, you know, stream this morning was that one of the first persons to actually sign all these petitions was the county sheriff.
Wow,
I know. And so, this is in Orange County, New York.
Orange County, New York.
And so, who would have thought that they would have had such a success? And actually, this is what I need to say. And I, you know, you can only guide people, but when they were looking for a venue weeks ago, they saw that there was a gun show coming. So they talked to the organizer and promoter of the gun show. And so in doing that, they said, well, we'd like to buy a table so that we can have people sign First Amendment petitions. And they came back and said, nope, we're not having any constitutional support at, you know, anything constitutional at this gun show.
Really?
And I said, what?
At a gun show?
Are you kidding me? They're not going to allow people to actually, you know, call and, you know, get other people to sign. And so I go, you got to be kidding me. Now, when you look at the patriots across America, what is the largest group of patriots across America?
Probably gun owners.
Yeah, the gun owners. I mean, you find that the abortion, you know, the anti-abortion movement, it's kind of fizzled out somewhat because of the Roe v. Wade. And that actually, I think, has been a bad thing because, not a bad thing, but what it has done is it kind of disarmed the national movement. And they weren't ready to shift into state movements. And now we're seeing states actually taking up and galvanizing abortion. And go ahead.
Let me share something with you. It's worse than that. They're in-state movements. But I have, we've got a team in Ohio who says that the pro-life organizations are actually, it's hard for me to say this, actually fighting local pro-life efforts. And I was stunned to hear that. I don't have all the details, but what happened is that Ohio lost the ballot initiative and the national pro-life movement was fighting our party members in Ohio who are pushing for for pro-life efforts. I was stunned by this. So when you say they're not transitioned, I think, you know, we've talked about how these organizations that kind of make a living on this may really not be interested in seeing it go away.
Right.
Okay. That may be an example. And,
right.
And if he hadn't seen this for himself and told me about it, I probably wouldn't have believed it.
Right. Right. Because actually, had the Supreme Court made a even more definitive move like that abortion is just absolutely illegal, not just immoral, but it violates the law when we're allowing life to be terminated. Mm-hmm. Something like that, to where, you know, it cannot be legalized. Abortion cannot be legalized in America except for these, you know, for medical purposes, you know, for mm-hmm. for saving the life of the mother or something like that.
Right.
I'm just, you know, however that gets caveated, because this would be written in a book of opinion. But
right.
My point is that when you actually have institutions that have lived for so long that there may have been, and the reason the Supreme Court may have done this is because they were signaled, okay, you can let that go because we now have control over that entire enough of that organization to basically, you know, move this forward and galvanize this through the states.
Jerry, you're sounding like a conspiracy theorist.
Well, it's not about being a conspiracy. I'm just using, you know, pragmatism, because it's all about management, and it's about management of agendas. And I don't see the Supreme Court as the guardians of the Constitution. They haven't been. They've actually been working to undermine the Constitution. And they have a job to do to make sure that, you know, we don't break free.
And we do have this annotated Constitution, which is based on Supreme Court precedent and case law.
Yeah, you know, that's
lawyers learned in law school.
Right, and that's their shining star, because every time they make these types of rulings, then, you know, their names and the courts get, you know, like the Warren Court or what have you, those things actually get listed in there that it was viewed by the Warren Court and did blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, Roberts, when it comes down to health care and that type of stuff, I'm sure eventually he'll have his name immortalized in that evil document. So anyway, but my point is that when we finally get, you know, an organization like what's happened in Orange County, and you get a sheriff, now the challenge is to get a sheriff, to get active public servants or people who are seeking public service to become the champion for this. This should be driving their campaign. And so there's a gentleman, I got to call him this week, in Iowa, and I'm hoping to have him on and talking about his campaign. And now that because I didn't realize he was running a campaign, we talked last week for the first time. And so what I'd like to do is offer him, you know, a great platform for him to actually attack, you know, those in the party who are not willing to support the Constitution, regardless of what party it is, and, you know, attack their public servants for, you know, completely turning their back and so forth. So anyway, you know, these are exciting times. I have to thank the Lord for being born at this point in time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll admit the frustrations are real, and the frustrations and stress, they're real. We're not, you know, I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and nor was I born to any affluence, nor am I at a point where I have any affluence. I have been blessed enough to be able to come to the realization, and blessed enough with the resources to basically broadcast them. But, you know, I don't have deep pockets to actually run, you know, because I'm sure I could get a PR person that says, okay, you got to throw an ad here. You got to do this. You got to do that. And because that's how they make their money.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, who knows? I could have maybe had somebody successful help drive the success of this, you know, potential movement or what have you. But I believe that there are people listening that actually, you know, this kind of galvanizes. This is clicking in their head, and the gears keep going around and around, and they're going, oh, my gosh, I need to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with that, we were covering the Constitutional Convention, and this is a document I'm still working on in formatting. But going through this, there's been a lot of little discoveries that I've made that, you know, there were – one would think that the room of men in this convention were all, you know, recognizing the moment in time that they had to stand up and that they really needed to do something. And as a matter of fact, I think overall, you know, when the spirit moved them, they all did, you know, maybe not consistently, because this is kind of interesting. As I realize, there were many men in this convention, more than one would think, that were parts of the cabal, the cabals of the states, where they did kind of point out that we shouldn't be doing this or we shouldn't be doing that. And some of these men actually didn't sign the Constitution.
Okay.
And some of these men went back and actually spoke out against the Constitution. And so we actually had, and I don't think that they were purists. I believe that, you know, George Mason, from what I know, what I've garnered, and this feeling I have in my heart, that George Mason was really a purist. He was trying to do what he thought was right.
Okay.
But in a way, wasn't Judas a purist?
I don't know.
In a way, didn't Judas justify that he felt that, you know, if he brought the Lord to, because he believed in the Lord, because clearly he didn't know, he didn't think that they were going to put him to death. He thought that they were actually going to have, you know, this groundbreaking point of communication. And so what he ended up doing is he actually didn't realize that he completely became the defiance that I believe was used as the justification of blasphemy, that he needed to be put to death or what have you.
Right.
I mean, it was all a bunch of trumped up charges, mm-hmm. but they used Judas reporting him as like, you know, the complaint of, you know, the law
right.
being broken. And
correct.
So when he realized, you know, how he was used, what did he do?
He murdered himself.
There you go. So, you know, there's no doubt in my mind he knew what he did after it happened. But I think he went into it not thinking that that really wasn't going to happen. He had this other vision. And I believe that not just George Mason was a Judas, but I believe that he was a purist and he really wanted to see the Bill of Rights and he wanted to see some very specific amendments. And he would just never be happy enough because it had to be perfect his way.
Well, eventually he got the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, he did get the Bill of Rights, but he still didn't get some of the things, like he didn't have the amendment to the militia. There were a lot of things he was pushing against that I believe, even if they conceded to 90% of those things and they gave him the Bill of Rights, he still wouldn't have signed that document because it had to be perfect to him.
Okay.
Does that make sense? So he was a real purist. As a matter of fact, I believe, so I read this book, and I forget who it was, but it was Madison's March on the Bill of Rights. It was, you know, how Madison was integral in bringing the Bill of Rights, even though he argued against it, how after the ratification of the Constitution, he ran a campaign that I'm going to give you the Bill of Rights, and he did it.
Okay.
And in that book, George Mason was involved in a meeting of concocting the amendments for a Bill of Rights, not concocting a meeting for a convention, but a meeting, you know, of, you know, what their demands for the full Bill of Rights. And so there's these people involved. And Patrick Henry, you know, passed this group of men that were kind of talking. And they said, hey, you know, get in on this because we're going to be a part of this. Patrick Henry, because I think these were the purists, that they weren't delegates. Only Mason was the delegate at the Constitutional Convention, and nor was Patrick Henry. But Patrick Henry listened to what they were doing. He goes, nah, you know, it's been ratified. I said I would support it, so I'm going to go and, you know, I don't want to be called out for not doing what I did. And then what he actually ends up doing was he starts doing gerrymandering, or Patrick Henry mandering, and, you know, made sure that the majority of the men that were going to be elected into office, he had a level of control so that they could become, you know, one, corrupted, and support a constitutional convention to undermine the Constitution. But the interesting thing was that Patrick Henry and George Mason weren't together on that. And that's my point. I think Patrick Henry knew George Mason, you know, very well. And he says, you know, I'm not going to include him in this. And I'm not going to include these men in this, because this was a group of purists in separation from those who were, you know, I don't want to say corrupt, but they didn't want to see the power and their control, because they thought that they had a very righteous state and, you know, they were very good leaders. They didn't realize the importance of this migration into the Constitution. So anyway, so when I look at many of these other men in the convention and how they constantly, you know, throw these, you know, they throw these pitches, oh, we should be doing this. And, you know, they're making good points, but they're constantly creating resistance. And I think the Lord used them to create resistance that needed to be in the Constitution, but these men still never signed into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think that they you know, they were trying to derail it so that it wouldn't succeed, but it did. Because I think there was enough of the churning, you know, because they weren't unified, you know, to try to kill it. This is why, you know, they would each be inspired that they needed to do this to this, and, you know, to try to derail it. And they all had their own little things. And because they weren't working together, they weren't successful. But the Lord actually succeeded by using them to create these checks and balances that went into this system. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Because when we get to this, we're going to actually get to, and I think, hold on a quick second, because I've got it documented, where the formation of the Constitution finally gets revealed, and it's a ways down. When would you think that the formation of the Constitution occurred? When they actually started, you know, talking about and laying out the Constitution?
When do I think the formation occurred? That's an interesting question, because I would think of the formation as the finished product.
Well, no. So when they actually started, because as they go through this, they have resolutions, they're talking in theories and blah, blah, blah. When do you think they said, okay, the Article 1 is going to be this, Article 2 is going to be this, Article 3 is going to be this, Article 4 is going to be this? When do you think they, you know, started doing that? You'd think that that would have happened in June or July time frame, right?
Well, okay. I would guess it wasn't in June or July time frame. I don't think it gelled that quickly. Right?
But they were diving into and looking at the Articles of Confederation so much, and so this is why we're actually going to go through, you know, this is going to be a point we're going to drive through. But it happened August 6th, where they actually, it was presented to the body of the whole this thing called, you know, this Constitution, where they actually had Article 1, Article 2. And here's the interesting thing. As you look at this, this was all done, you know, in the format that was just like the Articles of Confederation. In other words, there were like 20 articles. They added all the things that they were amending to. And as I started looking at it, I go, hold on here. You know, how is this much different? Other than the fact that they didn't consolidate and form it and tighten it up. I mean, it's kind of interesting, you know, how long it took to form.
So what you're saying is somewhere between August 6th and September 17th, transformation took place.
Yeah, it was more, I think that what they did was they started consolidating things.
Okay.
Because they were strewing, you know, powers throughout the different articles and roles and responsibilities. And they said, you know what? This all needs to be kind of tightened up, because this way, when we enumerate the powers, there will be no question as to what the powers that are granted. Mm-hmm. That right there in itself was a very divine move, because today, you know, look at people today. I read this article. I'm sorry, we're really eating up time. But I read an article this weekend regarding territory, state land, federal land, that the federal government can declare federal land, and they have this power. And this right. guy was reading Article 4 of the Constitution, which we read just a minute ago. Mm-hmm. And when he was reading Article 4 of the Constitution, actually it was Article 4, Section 3, what he said, and basically he took the second clause. So there's Article 4 is not the enumeration of powers. Article 4 is an enumeration of responsibilities and or roles that the federal government has. And right. so Article 3 or Section 3 of Article 4 that, you know, is admitting states into the union. This is the key for this whole section, is that they have this responsibility. And this guy actually, you know, reads and cites, the Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And he believes that states belong to the United States. Because bottom line, he was basically saying that they have this power over all things within the United States. And that's not true. That, right. you know, he's basically making this assumption that every state of the union is property of the United States, and the federal government could come in and take anything.
But then the next clause says, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States.
He didn't include that.
Particular state.
He didn't include that, nor did he include that the enumeration of properties in Article 1, Section 8. Mm-hmm. He didn't include that, oh, well, you know, they did happen to only enumerate that the only reason that there could be territories was to transition them to states. Nor right. did he even acknowledge that the federal government within the enumerated properties, there was a reason why it could only possess 10 nautical miles.
Mm-hmm.
Because it had to have autonomy, and the federal government was not to be the single most rich resource like the crown or the king, not to have that kind of power, because they knew property was wealth. It was the fundamentals property. Of wealth.
Right. So that leads me to a question I received this weekend. Since we touched on territories, and I had this question from more than one person, and I figured you might have, excuse me, a more definitive answer. Someone asked me this weekend, wasn't Thomas Jefferson's action in acquiring the Louisiana Purchase a violation of the Constitution? Now, I've heard that, okay, but I've never researched it or had any looked at the background on it. Have you got a response for that?
Yeah, so the purchase was handled via a treaty.
Okay.
And so here's the question, because, you know, the as I said earlier in this very show, that the federal government cannot make a treaty unless they have the authority over that.
Okay.
Does the federal government have authority, and or is there any authority regarding a territory?
Well, yeah, the federal
we just
government
read it. Has, we just yeah. read it that they right. have the authority to bring territories or any state into the union, so they can expand, they can grow, and that's exactly what they were doing. As a matter of fact, what was one of the first things that they were doing right after the signing of the Constitution? Hint, hint, it was a treaty regarding the Mississippi to secure that land.
Okay. Wow, sure.
Because so, even though they had a treaty with Britain that said, oh, you know, we possess the land all the way to the Mississippi, they needed to get the same kind of treaty out of France and Spain.
Okay, which they did.
Well, so...
right?
Did they? That's okay. the question. Did they?
Okay. Is this
so you got to remember that John Jay went out to do that. What ended up happening? What ended up happening when John Jay came back with the treaty from France and Spain? They laughed at him.
Okay.
And they, because they didn't accept it. I mean, it was such a badly written treaty that John Jay was a laughingstock.
Wow.
And so what ended up happening is we never secured that treaty. We ended up securing the treaty via the Louisiana Purchase. And that was done via a treaty. Instead of making a declaration, we just basically said, well, we're going to acquire this land. We're going to pay this much for it.
Okay.
And Napoleon accepted that. And so it came back. That contract was then presented, because what ended up happening was Thomas Jefferson was trying to do this, or actually I think his emissary was trying to do this unilaterally instead of actually putting it into a treaty. And I believe it was very quickly, you know, when it was received, it was very quickly put and presented as a treaty for the Senate to sign.
However, but you're saying it wasn't a treaty. So did we or did we not do that unilaterally?
Well, so it was not initially done as a treaty. It was done at, well, so technically, what's a treaty? Tell me, what is a treaty?
It's an agreement between nations.
Okay, so it's not like we were declaring war to steal this land. We were actually making an agreement, right? We were making an agreement with the Napoleon, the emperor, the despot of France.
Okay.
Okay, so how is that not a treaty? The only difference is instead of Jefferson unilaterally approving it, he sent it over to the Senate to say, I present the deal of the millennium.
Okay.
Because that's what it kind of was. It was until the purchase of Alaska, that was the deal of the millennium.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
And so, it, by the way, I guess the purchase of Alaska was probably the same thing then, right?
Yes. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, you know, how did we obtain the rest of the United States? So we obtained the rest of the United States. We'll cover this tomorrow. But we did the exact same thing with Britain, Mexico, and so forth. So we'll have to carry this up, and tomorrow we'll get started on the Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. Sorry we ended up going through this, but this is all important and makes me feel better. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.